Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Vogue Williams, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thanks. So Vogue, people know you these days primarily as a hugely successful podcaster and a broadcaster. And now you've written a book, Big Mouth, your autobiography.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, God, I hate that word so much. I know it's kind of what's said, but I feel like autobiography, I kind of like to see it as a collection of stories, a lot of which include me, but some which include other people. That's meant to be lighthearted and fun.
Yeah, yeah. Were you reading that off a card or something? Come here, you've a very funny line in the introduction. I don't know how much more of me people can take.
That is also true. But I tried to do it so that it was things that people had never heard about me before, which, if you can imagine, was difficult because I've put a lot out there.
Yeah, no, you found new stuff anyway. And look, it's a nice opportunity for us actually to look back on your life and times and kind of an amazing success story and a kind of a very 21st century success story, really. But you you always had a plan, didn't you?
I kind of did. Ever since I was very young, I had a plan of what I wanted to do. It started out with wanting to be famous. So me and all my friends just wanted to be famous. We didn't know for what. So I spent a long time trying to learn how to dance because I thought that pop stardom was the best way to get that. I can't sing, I can't dance. So that didn't work out. So I had to divert my path. And as we were speaking about earlier, I have spent a bit of time on the streets of Dublin modelling for ice cream and the lotto and hamburgers. So that's where I started off my career.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that. But people mightn't know this. You always had a fallback as a builder.
Yes, I did. I did. I'm actually, do you know what? So I basically have done 2 degrees, one in construction design and management and one in quantity surveying, which I really enjoyed. But I'm finally doing a TV show around construction.
So I was just going to say, thrilled. Yeah. So what are you going to do? Help people do up their houses or what?
Well, it's called Renovation Rescue. And basically the industry over here is, it's crazy. It's kind of, there's a few cowboys in here. So a lot of people are kind of taken for a ride with a builder. They've spent a lot of money and we're trying to figure out a way to get them back on the path to finishing their build.
Okay. I'm glad you're finally using your education, Vogue.
My stepdad is the most glad out of everybody.
Is he? Yeah.
He's the one who chipped in.
So then, there is one thing. You write about your childhood, right? And growing up in Howth. And I've noticed now, maybe everyone in Dublin knew this always, right? But it's only dawned on me slowly over the years. People from Howth, or the peninsula, as I think you call it, you're very attached to Howth and to being from Howth, aren't you?
We are obsessed with ourselves. If we were chocolate, we'd eat ourselves. I don't know what it is. And Howth is the kind of place that you go out and you could go out alone and you'd probably end up in a couple of parties. Everyone's very inviting into their house. But now I'm only a blow-in because I moved to Howth when I was 8, so I'll never be a proper Howthy. And I'm told about that quite often.
Are you from Sutton originally?
No, I'm not. Now, Sutton won't like me when they read the book because I do say Sutton is the road to Howth, but that's how we feel in Howth.
Yeah, I know. Howth people have a weird thing about Sutton, don't they? And do people from Sutton try and kind of say they're from Howth?
They've succumbed to the fact that they're from Sutton and they're doing the best they can. Doing the best they can down there. So they have the supermarket.
So you were a wild enough teenager, were you?
I was, and I think when my mum, I had to send my mum the book because I didn't want her reading headlines that would definitely get me in trouble. So I was like, just have a read. And she's still talking to me, which is fantastic. But yeah, I guess when I put all those stories together, she thought that I drank a lot. And I don't really like the taste of alcohol. I don't go to the pub. I don't drink a lot. But when you put all the fun, wild stories together, a lot of them involved alcohol. And I was a wild teenager.
Was part of that because your parents split up? Did you get away with more?
I mean, I know I'm not advocating for divorce here. I'm not. But it worked out very much in my favour because my dad, I'd go see my dad. My mum would say, no, you can't go to Oxygen Music Festival. Now, I was 16, so it was fair enough to say that. So then I'd go stay with my dad and I'd tell my dad I was going to stay with my friend Sarah and off I went to Oxygen. So I kind of did whatever I wanted by playing them off each other. I did get caught in the end, though.
Your dad, Freddie, he looms large in the book. You were really mad about him, weren't you?
I was mad about him. He was a big character.
Yeah, tell me a bit about him. He was colourful, fond of a drink.
Very I like to say that, yeah, he was fond of a drink. We spent a lot of time with him. A lot of that time was in the pub. But, I mean, my parents broke up when I was about 7 or 8, and he was very much involved in our life. Like, he really enjoyed picking us up and taking us out, and he was always there. He never let us down. And he was just a really, really great dad. But he was in and out of hospital for most of my life. And I think writing the book, it was only when I wrote the book that I thought that actually that had a massive effect on me from the age of 12, seeing my dad so unwell so often. And I kind of figured out a lot of things about myself from putting that down on paper. But
yeah, like what?
Like, I think I always thought that my anxiety stemmed from going through a very public breakup. But I think actually my anxiety probably stemmed from my dad being sick all the time and having to kind of deal with that as a very young girl at the time, and then him passing away when I was young enough as well. I think that whole thing probably was what started it off, because I was very unsure of how he was and if he, like, there was so many times that we were unsure if he'd make it, and I think that puts a lot of stress on a child for sure.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lack of safety or security or kind of that kind of thing.
Yeah, there. Yeah. It brings a sense of worry. You're constantly just worried about what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. And kids shouldn't be the ones worrying. Like, the parents should be doing the worrying for them. And it was tricky as well, was it? Because your mother, after they split up, she didn't even allow Freddie's name to be mentioned in the house. Is that right?
Not a fan. I think she was well within her rights to feel the way she did. I think that she went through a very difficult many years with my dad, and I think I find it, I say it in the book as well, I love my dad so much, but I wouldn't want to be married to him. And I think that she went through such a difficult time that she just, a lot of it just felt very stressful and triggering for her to hear about him, and it probably wouldn't be ideal. I mean, I've obviously been divorced, but there was no kids that I had, so there wasn't that connection where she always had that connection with us, and so I'd say that made everything even more difficult for her.
Now, when you say you wouldn't like to have been married to him, you say in the book that Freddie left you with this interesting legacy as well, which is that you've always been drawn to men who like a drink.
I know. Well, actually, a therapist informed me of that, because I think I went to therapy to try and figure out why I kept going for relationships that just were not working out. And I think when you're a child of somebody who drinks quite regularly, you find people drinking very regularly a normal thing. And I've always been, yeah, I've always been drawn to people like that, or people. I mean, I had my first crush was Eric Cantona. He was on my wall when I was 9, followed by Liam Gallagher. I mean, I was never going to do well and go for really nice boys. So I think that the whole thing with my dad, and I like a bad boy. There you go. That's just the way it is.
And Spencer, who I don't think he's a bad boy, like, but he was a bit too fond of the drink at one stage, was he, your husband?
Yeah, Spenny was definitely the life and soul of the party. Again, that's probably why I was attracted to him. But
and then once you got him, you beat it out of him.
I think it was so funny, because when I met him,
Spencer, all the things I found attractive about you initially, get rid of all that now.
I know you're a great crack, but stop that right now. No, he actually, do you know what the thing about people who drink, I've learned one great thing along my way in life, is you can't change somebody as much as you might want to. Don't bother, don't waste your time. I wasted a lot of my time trying to do it, even if it's for the better. Unless they want to do it, they won't do it. So Spenny, I just gave him the kind of ultimatum, well, you can continue doing what you're doing, but I'm not going to hang around for it. And then the change in him when he gave up alcohol, he started his non-alcoholic booze brand. It was night and day. He was just a completely different person, and he much prefers himself off the booze. As do I.
And now he runs 30 marathons in 30 days. Like, what's all that about, do you think? What point is he trying to prove?
I'd say it's tough to live with me now. I think that's a big part.
Okay.
No, he actually, do you know what? And people say that, oh, well, is he not just changing one addiction for another? And I said, I mean, being addicted to running and being addicted to drinking are very different things. And he just... he loves it. He loves the fundraising aspect of it. He loves pushing himself. He's always trying to get, like, he's convinced that I'm going to do a marathon with him one day. He just will not accept that it's not going to happen. But I think he gets so much out of running and trying to push his body. So he's got something else now. I always get it wrong. I think he's got 7 Ironmen in 7 continents in October. I think that's what he's doing next. So,
wow.
Always on to the next thing.
Yeah. There's a guy who's got a lot of energy to burn up. Yeah. And you and him are quite competitive.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say. About most things, to be honest. He is a better runner than me. I can accept that. And I'm gracefully bowing out of that race. But I'm a better tennis player. And I'm more organised. And I can use a washing machine. And he doesn't even know the difference between a washing machine and a dryer. So I'm winning in the
home front.
I'd say
that's a competition he's happy to be losing there. You're there like, I'm winning at doing the laundry. And he's like, you are. You're so great. It must be exhausting, though. Are you competing all the time kind of thing on a low level, yeah?
I wouldn't say we're competing all the time. The good thing about our relationship is that we kind of enjoy doing the same things. So it's not like I'm like, right, on Saturday, we're going to do this and he's just rolling his eyes. We're kind of happy to be doing the same things as each other. So that really works out quite well
for us. I think that's the key to a happy marriage. People talk a lot of rubbish about lots of different things, but if you both like doing the same things,
yeah, exactly. We do. Yeah. I mean, he dipped his toe in with the golf. I'm glad he didn't go ahead with it fully, because that does take up a lot of time. But generally, we just enjoy doing the same stuff, so we're not too competitive all the time.
And so you and the drink then, like, as you mentioned earlier, like you do kind of portray, and in the book, people could think parts of it. Okay, she's a bit of a party girl, but the drink doesn't really suit you, I think, you think, yeah?
I definitely was a party girl, and I always think, thank God, when I was in uni in Aberdeen, there were no, like, camera phones and things like that, because we just were all having a great time, to be honest with you, and nobody had to know about it. But I've never liked the taste of alcohol. If I drink, I'm not going to have one drink, I'm going to have 5 or 6 drinks. And I don't do it very often, because, again, that's something that would be very bad for my anxiety. I wake up the next day and, like, I can't just remember the nice time I had. I just catastrophize everything that happened the day before and everything that's going to come forward and how bad it was for my health. So I try and not drink very often, but I have to say I'm looking forward to a margarita tomorrow night now.
So the anxiety, that's still there with you in general, is it?
I think the thing with anxiety is, it's not something that you'll ever get rid of. It's kind of something that you manage. And sometimes I do a better job of managing it than others. I think that
give me an example of how it would be for you.
I think on it, if I look, I don't look at my diary more than a week in advance, because that can kind of stress me out. I like to just exercise, sleep well, that always helps with it. But
yeah,
sometimes for no reason I can just kind of lose the run of myself. I've written it about it in the book a couple of times, where I had what would be described as a panic attack. And you kind of, when you come out of that, you're like, God, what was I thinking? You can't believe that your mind went to those places and was able to catastrophize something that is absolutely pointless to do, but it does happen. But I like to keep a stockpile of, I have medication for it as well, if I ever feel that I just feel a bit overwhelmed. And I think it's something that, it almost used to be embarrassing to talk about years ago, but I think a lot of people deal with it in different ways, and people have their own anxieties and stresses. Spencer has none, by the way, which is unusual. So it's all a learning curve
really
for him now.
Spencer completely enlightened, like, yeah, never questions himself or anything, yeah?
I asked him, I was like, if you could swap your body with one other famous person in the world, who would it be? He said, nobody. I just want to be me. And I was like, and you know that question, someone's like, okay, if you could change one thing about yourself, what would you change?
Yeah.
And I could literally go on like a list as long as my arms. Spenny's like, nothing, why would I? And I think it's actually a really nice way to be.
It's a great way to be. Yeah, you'd know he wasn't Irish, wouldn't you?
Yeah. And he can accept a compliment. An Irish person cannot and will not accept a compliment.
Yeah. Listen, going back to Freddie for a second, people will remember that you did this reality show on RTE called Fade Street. You do go back over all your greatest hits, the modelling, Fade Street.
My greatest hits.
Which was, you know, kind of, it was a big talking point at the time, I'll put it that way. But Freddie died around that time. So that must have been a weird time for you. Like, you were really kind of very, very publicly exposed and everything. And then in the middle of that, he died.
Yeah, it was. He died the day after the first episode aired. And I always like to say that he died of embarrassment. So it was quite strange. I actually remember, now that you've mentioned that, there was a pap at his funeral. And I was like, that is such a strange thing to send someone like that, because anyway, that happened, and I think the whole thing was, it was just really strange.
I feel Freddie would have liked that, would he? The paparazzi at his funeral.
Oh, my dad loved it. Like, whenever I was on doing the modelling on TV3 or something like that, or at RTE, he was always the one to watch. He always had all the papers of when I was in the papers showing his friends. So I think he would have been absolutely delighted. Yeah, he loved it. He was very supportive.
Now, you've referenced earlier your first marriage. You don't actually mention his name, I think, in the book, as far as I could see, to Brian McFadden from Westlife, just to give people a perspective.
You
there,
certainly
okay?
threw it in there, Brendan. Yeah.
Well, like, otherwise it'd be a very abstract conversation, but now people can see the pictures, okay?
Yeah.
So the thing is, you basically, it sounds like you knew that was a mistake before you even married him, did you?
Yeah, and I think if you asked him the same question, I think he'd probably say the same thing. I think that I was certainly very young. My dad had just died. I'd come out of a really long-term relationship, and then I met him and we went to Australia, and I kind of used it as an escape to get away from what I would describe as all the sadness that I was kind of surrounded in after everything that had happened. But you know what? I genuinely don't regret it. I think everything that you do in life, it brings you to where you are. And even with meeting other people, and like even me meeting Spencer, and I think everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
And like, I'm very careful in the book. I don't want to throw anyone under the bus. I didn't feel like there was any need to it, because it's meant to be like a nice, happy, kind of funny book.
Yeah.
And I think that I describe stuff pretty much the way they were, and certainly the way that I felt that they were. And I just think it kind of felt like a bit of a disaster from the get-go, really.
And the end of the marriage then, it feels like, from the book, that was a real knockback for you, was it?
I felt like that was my... I felt really like, I think, to fail so publicly as well, I think a lot of people just assumed it was going to happen anyway, so it was kind of like an I told you moment.
Okay,
and there was a lot of interest in it at the time, and I don't think I was equipped to deal with something like that as it was happening. I didn't like have a really solid team around me either that knew what to do. I didn't know what to do. I just felt really embarrassed by the whole thing. I felt like a lot of people kind of had considered that that was the way it was going to end, so that felt really difficult for me. I think I went through a really bad time, like with anxiety and stuff around that time, because I did find it very difficult to deal with all of that.
Yeah. Embarrassed. Yeah. Like, it's an old fashioned word, but like embarrassment in public like that is kind of hurts, doesn't it?
I know it does. And you can't get away from it. You just have to accept it. Accept it and just kind of hang your head in shame for a while and then come back out.
How did you get past it?
I think, and I hate saying this to people, because sometimes people that I know break up with people, and the only thing that you get past it with is time.
Yeah.
And I think as well, for me, it was really important, because I'd been in a 6.5 year relationship before that. Then I was in whatever that was, 5 years or something. And then I hadn't been single like for so long in my whole life. And I really wanted to take that time. I hated it at the start because I didn't want to be on my own. I was always used to having someone, like I always had someone to go to a party with or someone to do something with. Whereas now I kind of had found myself at 31, I think. And I wanted to be married with kids by the age I was 30. Everyone puts a weird time frame. So I kind of assumed that that was it for me. I was never going to have kids, which were really important to me. And I was never going to meet anyone. And I kind of went into this spiral for a while. And then actually, after about 6 months of being single, I thought, this is great. I'm actually really enjoying myself. I'm living on my own with one of my friends, living on my own. I was always going to live with someone else. I'd never live on my own. Right. And I just kind of found my own way with it. And then I ended up having a great time.
Yeah, and I know you'd want to say to people as well, there's no shame in it. There's no shame in when like a relationship doesn't work out or a marriage doesn't work out. But your point is that it was all so public and everything else like that. Yeah.
I think like for any breakup, you just feel that you feel You always question, like, could I have done something differently? Could I? And actually, do you know what? You're right. There is no shame. There's, like, it happens to all of us. You're going to make mistakes along the way. I'm going to make probably loads more mistakes. And I kind of just, I don't get really embarrassed anymore about things. Maybe it's when you get older, because I'm turning 40 this year. And I just think when you get to that age, you kind of get to a point where you're like, actually, I'm kind of comfortable in my life. And even if I do things that are a bit ridiculous, I don't feel embarrassed anymore. I'm just like, it's just the way things are.
Yeah. Is that the success of the podcast, you think? Like, I mean, my therapist ghosted me with Joanne McNally. Is a full on kind of cultural phenomenon at this stage. Is it about that openness and having no shame?
We certainly do not. I think with a podcast, when you start a podcast, you can always do a thing where you're like, oh, I can't say that. Oh, I couldn't say that. And I just think with Joanne and I, we just have such free-flowing conversations anyway. And the same with my sister when I do a pod with her. And obviously they're edited after. And we don't put absolutely everything in because we could talk for an hour. It's usually a 45-minute podcast. And I think that for us, it was more about just being open and honest and just... Otherwise, it just wouldn't be as good of a product, I don't think, if you're just restricting yourself all the time. And sometimes even when, like, a paper might take something I said out of context, I'm like, oh, I shouldn't say something like that. And then I just think, you know, I didn't actually say anything bad. They just took it out of context and it looks bad. And I'm not going to stop myself from doing it, because at the end of the day, we're trying to create something that people enjoy listening to. Feels like you're kind of sitting chatting with your friends, and you just have to be more honest and open.
Yeah. But look, it's not just that either. I mean, I know everyone probably says this, do you know, but didn't I always tell you were a star? Like, you always had incredible charm, charisma, likability, and you just have it.
That's very kind of you. I think I just enjoy, I really love all the different aspects of my job. I have a very short attention span as well, so it's nice for me to switch from thing to thing to thing. I'd love to be doing this in 10, 15 years' time. I think even with writing a book, I found... With I never stop. My mind is never kind of quiet. And I think when I was writing the book, I found it really cathartic, and I enjoyed the process of writing. And when I first started writing the book, the reason for writing the book was because I really wanted to get into fiction writing, because I love reading, and I just love books. And I think that will be probably my next step.
Brilliant. Is that next? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I really, really want to do. And I love, do you know, even Graham Norton, who I'm obsessed with, I probably have mentioned him too many times in the book.
You are, yes. Have you met him yet, like, or have you, you know?
I met him and he was even better than I expected. I was thrilled. Yeah, I have to stop talking about him. He's going to avoid me if he ever sees me in public. But I loved what his career, where he wrote two autobiographies, and they're really funny. And then he moved into fiction, and his fiction writing is so incredible. Like, I can only dream of doing something like that, but I'm certainly going to give it a good go.
Okay. So the main thing... I can't believe about all this is that you're going to be 40 soon. How are you feeling about that?
I'm actually feeling very excited about it, because I'm very frightened of the alternative, which is not being 40 being dead and gone. So I think being 40, I feel like it's a really good milestone. Like, I've got three amazing kids, a great husband, my family are fantastic. I think I'm in a really good position in my life, and I'm enjoying it. I'm being 40. I mean, I think the thing about turning 40 is when we were younger, we'd look at 40-year-olds and be like, oh my God, they are like so old and battered. But then you're turning 40 and you're like, hang on, we aren't.
Oh yeah.
And I think I'm excited for this decade. Everyone says it's meant to be amazing in your 40s, and I'm going to do a little party at home in Ireland. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, actually.
Yeah. The maintenance gets harder, though, does it? You kind of talk a little bit about your regime in the book. There's a lot of stuff to get done to keep looking that good, isn't there?
There's a lot of stuff, Brendan. There is a lot
of stuff. So there's Botox?
I finally admitted the Botox. Yeah, of course.
Botox, Profilo. How does the Profilo differ from Profilo's the Botox?
More injections. I mean, I'll go and see somebody, and if they say, "Oh, there's a lot of downtime to this treatment," I'm like, "Sign me up." Anything, your face will be swollen, sign me up. I had my son's third birthday in Ireland, and she was like, "No, you'll be very swollen tomorrow." I was like, "No, my face doesn't swell." Well, the next day I thought, oh my God, all my friends are going to be like, what has she done to herself? But yeah, I'm all for it. Anything that hurts is good for your face, and I'm willing to do it.
Okay. So Big Mouth is published by HarperCollins. It's out next Thursday. Well, that's May 22nd. Yes. Vogue, you're doing a live event on Monday, May 26th. Then in Vicar yes. Street in Dublin. Are there still tickets available for that?
Still tickets available for that. Thank you so much.
Vogue, it's been fantastic to talk to you. And listen, give my regards to Spencer. You know I was very smitten with him that one time we met. Like he's a very, very attractive, charming kind of individual. He swept me off my feet. He really did. He's fantastic.
He does.
So do give him my best, will you?
I certainly will.
And I hope I see him again. I hope it's a long road and I hope sometime in my life again that I will see Spencer again. I really do.
I'll make it happen for you. I'll make it happen for you.
Vogue Williams, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Email brendan@rte.ie.